we see lots of opportunities at the mid to smaller end of US companies, but they're not the ones that you see in the newspaper day to day.
Welcome to The Greener Way. I'm your host, Michelle Baltazar, Executive Director of Media at FBAS Sustainability. We're recording on Gadigal land, and we pay our respects to the traditional custodians of country and elders, past and present. In this episode, we chat with Pablo Beruti, who's the Senior Portfolio Specialist with Stewart Investors. He joined Stewart Investors in July 2019. We'll be talking about investment opportunities in global emerging markets. And stick with us until the end of this episode to find out, has the world of emerging markets changed since the tariff announcement in April? Will there be a fundamental change in strategy for fund managers if climate transition concessions and government support go away? We'll find out. Pablo, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Michelle. Nice to be here.
A little bit about Pablo. He has more than 15 years' experience in sustainable investment across leading investment firms. He is also the co-founder and managing director of Altiorum, a not-for-profit library and resource center dedicated to supporting advocates for a sustainable financial system. So, Pablo, once again, thanks for joining us. But for those who are not familiar with Stewart Investors, tell us about the work that you do.
Thanks, Michelle. So Stewart Investors was established in 1988 as a fund manager investing in listed equities from Edinburgh in the Asia Pacific region. Over the course of the more than 30 years that we've been investing, we learned a lot of lessons about how to invest successfully in Asia Pacific in emerging markets. And one of the very first lessons we learned was that the fastest way to lose clients' money is to entrust it to the wrong people. And so our focus for the longest time has been on trying to find stewards of companies, leaders of companies who we can trust with our clients' capital. And a lot of the ESG and sustainability considerations that people have has become common in subsequent years were good proxies for trying to understand whether we could trust the leaders of businesses with our clients' capital. So how do they treat their workers? Do they take their environmental responsibilities seriously? Are they too close to government, potentially corrupt? Those types of questions were questions that we asked ourselves from all the way back in 88. In 2005, we launched our first dedicated sustainable development focused strategy. We wanted to extend the work that we were already doing to really try and identify companies that were contributing to and benefiting from our big sustainable development themes. And this was largely focused on human development because it was in those emerging market and Asia Pacific areas. As we grew that out and started to invest globally in global equity strategies, environmental solutions and the integration actually of social and environmental issues must go together because they're very interdependent, became a bigger and bigger part of how we thought about what a good quality company that's contributing to sustainable development is. Coming to today, we invest in worldwide strategies, global emerging market strategies, Asia Pacific and also India.
That's crazy to be thinking about the beginnings of ESG and sustainability discussions back in the early 2000s and even way back in the 90s. I do remember talking about responsible and social investing in the early 90s. So it's great to see that Stewart Investors has evolved and expanded. And the reason for the podcast today is really to focus on your emerging market strategies. So tell us briefly about that.
So regardless of which strategy that we are focused on, the investment philosophy and the process is the same across all of our strategies. And so essentially there's five components. The first is that we're looking for companies that are high quality. And when we talk about high quality, we're talking about the management teams, as I've already mentioned. We're talking about the business quality, and they may be traditional things that investors talk about, like moats and margins and things like that. But also, we're really looking for companies that are producing necessary products and services that are essential for helping drive sustainable development outcomes. We're looking for quality in terms of the financials. And for us, that is around resilience. And so strong balance sheets, margins which are enduring, being able to be transparent and clear in the way that the financials and the accounts are put together. And even simple things like, are they paying a reasonable rate of tax? So they're the things that go into quality. In terms of sustainability, we're thinking about companies that are contributing largely through their products and services. And we try to take quite a nuanced view of that. So they're the first two components of the philosophy. The third is that we're very bottom up. So we don't think that market indices are a particularly good guide as to what a high quality company contributing to sustainable development is. And so it means that we need to go out there and meet with companies and really try and understand companies from the bottom up. Then we also take quite a long-term view. And so when we're investing at the point of investment, we're thinking 10 years plus as an ideal holding period. And some companies we've had held for 20 years or longer. And so that long-term mindset, I think, helps us to identify opportunities that perhaps others are missing when they're thinking about the next month or quarter or year. And then lastly, we're very focused on preserving clients' capital. We believe that companies that are able to be resilient in difficult periods are able to be more successful over the longer run because they can act countercyclically. And so, for example, that strong balance sheet and having cash on the balance sheet in difficult times allows companies to retain their employees, to continue to invest in R&D, potentially to acquire competitors and gain market share that way. And what that means in practice for the way that our funds perform in different market conditions is that when markets are running really strongly, then we're not going to keep up as well because a lot of speculative investments will be doing quite well in those periods. But
yes,
when markets are falling, our funds tend to hold up and preserve capital. And if you then play that forward over many years, that compounding of returns is what allows us to beat the market index over the long run.
You got me at the question, are they paying reasonable taxes? I mean, you're probably the first investment professional I've spoken to who's talked about the tax rate and the fairness of that in general. So that's fantastic to see. Now, again, back to the emerging markets sector. Investors in insured investors would have seen a performance lag of the EM index versus the general global index. And ultimately, a lot of people do look at this. How are you performing against the index? So how does this play into your strategies from this year onwards?
So for us, we think it's never been a more exciting time to be an investor in emerging markets because it's often when the rest of the world and the markets are ignoring those areas that you find the greatest opportunities. And so over the last few years, we've seen this increasing concentration in the United States in terms of capital flows, and in particular with the Magnificent Seven giant tech companies dominating both the conversation and the returns of the S&P and global indices, for instance. And at the same time, we see that other markets have become undervalued, and I hesitate to say markets because we are very bottom-up focused, but take, for instance, China as an example, which became very out of favor. Even though there are still some very high-quality companies within China, and while we apply a fairly cautious approach when we're investing in China, it has presented itself opportunities. We've been investors in India for a very long time, and the domestic sustainable development and growth story within India is such that there are so many fantastic businesses that have very long-term tailwinds behind their future growth. And then with more recent times where you've seen issues around the tariffs being implemented and then taken away and then implemented
yes.
again, and all of the volatility that flows from that, that's given us some opportunities to invest in some or add additional capital to some of our favorite names in companies like VEG, which is a Brazilian manufacturer of electric motors and renewable energy technologies and transformers, which has suffered a little bit as a result of the tariffs, but which over the long run has got a very good position. And as an example, their pipeline for transformers in the United States has never been stronger, and it's not easy to replace the essential products that they provide to the electricity grid in the US. And so while the tariffs will certainly impact them, their prospects remain as strong as ever.
Now, you've mentioned a Brazilian stock there. Always when we talk about emerging markets, everyone talks about BRIC or certain countries. And I'd like to think about Brazil and Mexico as two countries that are of interest to a lot of fund managers here in Australia as well. So do you look at those? I know that you said bottom up and we're talking about country specific, but how are the opportunities in general in those two countries?
Sure. I mean, it can be quite difficult to generalize as a bottom-up investor because in every country, in every market, there are fantastic companies and there are very poor quality companies which we would never invest in. And quite often, the majority of the market, and in fact, in pretty much all cases, the majority of the market is uninvestable to us because they just don't meet the types of qualities that we're looking for. We do try to act opportunistically as well when the opportunity arises. I mentioned VEG. A Mexican example would be Walmex, which is the Walmart of Mexico. Now, they are trading on a PE that is the lowest it's been since 1996, and yet they've been able to achieve excellent earnings growth over the last decade and expect to double those earnings again over the course of the next few years. And so we think that those companies are undervalued at the moment, and they present very high quality businesses that are contributing to sustainable development in those markets. And so there are other countries in emerging markets that also don't get a lot of attention, like the Philippines, which is a bit closer to home for us here in Australia. They are seldom talked about, and valuations in the Philippines are very compelling for high quality businesses. There are also obviously very poor quality businesses, so taking that bottom up approach is really important. One example that we've reinvested in recent times is the Bank of Philippine Islands. Now, this bank has a history going back to 1851. They're stewarded by the Ayala family, who have an excellent nation building and clean reputation. And what's compelling about the Philippines, particularly in the context of global trade wars, is that only about 56% of Filipinos have bank accounts. And if you compare that to about 80% in India, there is huge structural growth for the banking sector in the Philippines. And with a bank like BPI, or the Bank of the Philippine Islands, they're an incredibly conservative bank. They were the standout survivor of the Asia crisis in the Philippines, for instance. And they're providing lots of digital services that are inclusive for the poorest of people across the country. So, for instance, their Banco mobile app allows deposits for as small as 1 peso, which is about 3 Australian cents. And so that's about as inclusive as you can get. They're also leaders in microfinance for housing, microinsurance, and they're the leading funder of renewable energy and have committed to being out of fossil fuels by 2032. And so when you see a company like that is sort of been ignored by the market because it's focusing on other things, then we see that there's a very excellent long-term opportunity for us as investors to be able to back them to continue to grow.
That's great. Now, with mobile phones, a lot of people probably have a Samsung phone. As of March this year, you increased your allocation to the stock and stated that it's a stock that you'd hold for the next decade, going back to what you said earlier. But why is this stock attractive for an EM fund with a responsible investing or sustainability philosophy?
Sure, there's quite a few reasons, actually. There's very rarely one thing that makes an investment case for a company for us. Now, in the case of Samsung, it is a company that we held a while back. And then for several years, we didn't because they had various corporate governance and other issues. In recent times, we've seen a very notable improvement in corporate governance for the company. They issued a public apology, which is extremely rare for a Korean or Asia-based company to make. And they apologized to their shareholders, their staff, their other stakeholders for their past performance. They've shifted their compensation structures to be from being quite short-term to being longer-term equity-based. They've done some buybacks, which shows that they believe that the company is undervalued. And we mentioned some geopolitical issues before, they're quite differentiated from the China or outside of the China-US trade conflict, but provide key technologies that are similar to some of the companies that get the most attention within that conflict. From a sustainable development standpoint, Samsung has been a key nation builder within Korea. So back in the 1950s, GDP per capita in Korea was on a par with Ivory Coast. Now, Samsung today is 20% of Korean exports. It employs 266,000 people and has more than 2,000 suppliers. Now, it's not a perfect company by any stretch. There are labor issues there, which we engage on. There are other issues that we continue to engage on, but we see a very determined improvement in the way that they operate. It's also worth pointing out from a sustainable development perspective that you mentioned phones and Samsung phones, and technology and access to those types of smart devices are increasingly important for access to finance, access to healthcare, access to education. And so we think that those products are essential to sustainable development, but it's also how they are done. And so when you look at Samsung's product set, many of them are energy efficiency leaders. They've got really clear targets around improving energy efficiency across all of its products, including its homewares, white goods, and the like, and track the emissions saved from the energy efficiency improvements that they're making. And when you look at their operational footprints compared to their competitors, they're leading their competitors in terms of greenhouse gas intensity, energy use, recycling of water, recycling of materials, or avoidance of waste going into landfill. And so they have a very strong foundation to build on. And what we noticed was a couple of things that gave us additional conviction. So one is that in addition to their more general improvements in corporate governance, they took a much more serious approach to sustainability. And so in 2022, they joined the Global Compact. They implemented improved board governance around this, around sustainability. And in relation to an engagement, a collaborative engagement that we've been leading for several years now on conflict minerals in the Congo, in the electronics sector, we were surprised to find that Samsung's actually one of the leaders in this area. They have a very extensive reporting on how they ensure that their supply chain is as conflict mineral free as it can be. All of their smelters are certified through the RMI, Responsible Minerals Initiative. And they've been doing on-ground work in the DRC, for instance, by training 12 artisanal mining cooperatives, which is more than 1,500 miners, with support from the German government to try and formalize some of that informal economy around conflict minerals, in particular cobalt, in the DRC. And so it is a story of evolution for Samsung, where we think that if we can back this company for the next decade and they continue to improve, they can add a lot of value for us as shareholders, but also make a very profound difference to the world.
Now, we've talked a lot about emerging markets, but I also want to look at the other side of the spectrum, which is the US shares. And any investor would always look at, how do I diversify my portfolio? Do you consider the performance of the US shares versus global ex-US when you're trying to determine your overall performance, for example? How do you provide a diversified portfolio for your investors?
So our portfolios are built on conviction around the risk and return that we believe we can achieve from the companies that we're investing in. And so our portfolios typically look nothing like the benchmark. Often they're more than, the industry term is active share. So it's a measure of how different we are from the benchmark, and that we're typically more than 90% different from the benchmark across our funds. And we don't look at the benchmark when we're trying to pick companies. In terms of diversification, though, it's absolutely important, and there are parameters in there to ensure that we do stay diversified across countries and industries. But what we've seen with the concentration in the US over the last several years, particularly in those large seven tech companies, is that the market has gone, the top 10 has gone from being 14% of the S&P 500 to being 34% since 2013. So it's quite an extraordinary concentration
build-up. That is insane. That is insane. I don't think mom and dad investors realize this concentration, just the drastic change from 14% to 30% plus.
It's an extraordinary shift, and it's also not cheap. So while unlike the tech wreck of 2000, these companies are making revenues. They are real businesses that are making genuine revenues and good returns for investors. But the US market is almost 25 times price to earnings. And typically when the US market's traded at that level, the following 10 years of returns have been 5% or less. And so it is expensive historically. And so what that does for us is suggest that there's lots of opportunities elsewhere to be able to deliver good returns for our clients. And so we've talked a bit about Asia and emerging market opportunities, but even within the US, smaller companies have not benefited from the capital flows into the United States. They've underperformed compared to those very large cap companies. But there's a lot of excellent businesses in the US who are well positioned to support the upgrading of infrastructure and housing stock, which is absolutely essential for the United States, as they have a significant housing crisis. They have very old infrastructure. And so companies like WabTech, who do rail infrastructure, not just in the US. So they do locomotives, passenger and cargo in the US, but also globally. You've got advanced drainage systems. These are companies that most people have never heard of. Now, advanced drainage systems make plastic pipes for water transport to replace those concrete pipes. Now, concrete pipes are very greenhouse gas intensive and they're quite leaky. Advanced drainage system uses largely recycled plastic, and while they're a company that makes water pipes, they're the largest recycler of plastic in the United States. And so from a sustainability and an essential infrastructure perspective, these are fantastic companies that have very long-term tailwinds. On the housing side, we've got companies like NVR who do modular housing, which makes it more affordable and cheaper to build houses. And from a climate resilience perspective, you've got companies like Carlisle who do waterproofing, insulation, other building envelope materials, which can help protect houses in times of storm and flood. And another company, just one other example, TopBuild, who do insulation, which is obviously incredibly important for being able to reduce the energy footprint of housing. And so we see lots of opportunities at the mid to smaller end of US companies, but they're not the ones that you see in the newspaper day to day.
And now for the bonus round, I know that this is one of the topics that you're very passionate about as well, but DEI, the conversations around DEI, there's been a change in the mood and enthusiasm, and it has been shelved, quote unquote, recently after the US reversed its stance on this. What does this mean for companies that continue on with their DEI policies? And how can you tell that it's still happening in the background despite the lack of support, let's say, from legislation?
Yeah, it's a really important issue because it is troubling that basic principles of fairness and anti-discrimination and inclusivity have become politicized. I mean, they're things that I think most people would support if they're being done well. And perhaps what has left sort of DEI and other three-letter acronyms like ESG open to criticism is that there is DEI washing. There's been a lot of programs that have achieved very little, and any type of three-letter acronym that's not well understood leaves itself open to being attacked. In the US, we've noticed that companies have changed some of the language, so they talk about culture or fair hiring now instead of using the DEI acronym. And those companies that were running genuine DEI programs, they were experiencing the benefits from that in terms of the talent they were able to attract, the retention of talent within their businesses, and then it's become quite embedded. And so it's hard to go back for them. And if they do, they risk alienating their employees and alienating prospective talent when they're trying to hire. Other companies that have more shallow programs have been very quick to roll them back. And maybe that's a good thing, that we can actually bring some of that into the light now and make better judgments as investors. If I were to sort of step back from a global perspective, we're just about to release our annual report for 2024, and looking at the numbers for DEI in the companies of the 201 companies that we invested in as at the end of the year across all of our funds, 3 years ago, 14 of those companies had no female directors. Now that's down to 6. 76 had one female director. Now that's down to 54. 59 had 30% or greater female directors, and now that's 88 companies. And so we're seeing improvement across the board and around the world. And the story is similar, and importantly, for female managers, because that's where the pipeline for future directorships come from. And so of the 141 companies of those 201 that report on diversity in management, more than half have greater than 30% female managers now, and that's up from 43% 3 years ago. And so we are seeing that the change and the improvements and the benefits that companies can experience, and I think that companies wouldn't continue to do this stuff if they didn't see that there were benefits from doing it, is real and it's tangible. And it's also true of the US too, because in the US, at least for the companies that we invest in, the number of female directors is 32% as of the end of last year. And that has also improved over the last few years. And so when you start digging into it a little bit more deeply, and particularly when you're focused on high quality companies that recognize the benefits of having strong diversity and inclusion programs, I think that we won't see that go away anytime soon.
As they say, what gets measured gets done. So it's fantastic to see just this active initiatives really in the past 5 years or past decade. I mean, here in Australia, we have Women in Super and other organizations as well pushing for gender equality, which is just one aspect of DEI, of course. Pablo, this has been a very insightful interview with you. It's good to look under the bonnet of what you invest in. Thank you for joining us.
Really appreciate the time. Thank you, Michelle.
This is The Greener Way. I'm your host, Michelle Baltazar. Thank you for listening.
The Greener Way podcast is a product of FS Sustainability. All information in this podcast is for education and entertainment purposes only. It is not intended as a substitute for professional, legal, or tax advice. Before making any financial decisions, you should read the product disclosure statement and, if necessary, consult a licensed financial professional. For more information, head to the disclaimer page on the FS Sustainability website, fssustainability.com.au.